This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. George Herbert Walker Bush made quite an impression on the nation in his 4 years as president.
I think character matters a lot. I think you have to have a moral compass. Doesn't mean you have to have a pristine personal life. I never liked all these intrusions and stuff, but patriotic values, sense of service, those things mean something to me.
His legacy as a forward thinker on foreign policy and as a good friend and a family man were confirmed this week as America said goodbye to its 41st commander-in-chief. We will remember the first President Bush, President 41, along with the rest of the nation today. And we'll also talk about some of the big stories you may have missed this week and some stories that are breaking as we speak. Joining us in studio for the Friday News Roundup is Jessica Taylor, the lead digital political reporter at NPR. Jessica, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thank you.
Also back with us is Marketplace senior reporter Kimberly Adams. Kimberly, welcome.
Thanks, Joshua.
And at WFAE Public Radio in Charlotte is a previous guest of 1A, but new to the Roundup. David Priest is the chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute, best known for the national security website lawfareblog.com. He's a former intelligence officer at the CIA, where he served as Robert Mueller's daily intelligence briefer for more than a year. His latest book is called How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. David, welcome to the Roundup.
Hi, Joshua. Good to be with you.
We'd also love to hear from you, your thoughts, questions, or comments about this week's top stories. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. George H.W. Bush is in his final resting place on the grounds of his presidential library at Texas A&M University. His burial yesterday culminated the first presidential state funeral in more than a decade, from Houston in a presidential plane to Washington, where he lay in state at the Capitol, to the Washington National Cathedral for an official funeral, back home to Texas for another memorial, and then a train trip to College Station, Texas. That's where the presidential library is. President George W. Bush eulogized his father at the National Cathedral.
Your decency, sincerity, and kind soul will stay with us forever. So through our tears, let us know the blessings of knowing and loving you, a great and noble man, the best father a son or daughter could have. And in our grief, let us smile knowing that Dad is hugging Robin and holding Mom's hand again.
President George W. Bush giving one of a number of beautiful eulogies at the service at Washington National Cathedral. Former First Lady Barbara Bush died months before the late President Bush. She's also buried at the library alongside Robin, their daughter, who died of leukemia at age 3. I'd love to get your thoughts here on the panel about the legacy of President Bush, starting, David Priest, with you, particularly your view as a political historian. I wonder what came to your mind first when we had learned that President Bush had passed away.
He represents so many things about the country that people think are representative of a bygone era, that this is something we're missing now and we won't get it back. What I found striking about the eulogies inside the National Cathedral and the commentary around it was something else, which was the reminder that he gives us about those values, that there's a void that we will fill, not that we will leave unfilled, that in fact his career of service, his dedication to country, his dedication to family should be an inspiration and not a lament of times past.
David, you served in the CIA under George W. Bush, the 43rd president, and you've written that, quote, the modern way the presidency interacts with the intelligence community began with the elder President Bush. What do you mean by that?
That's right. Before George H.W. Bush, no president had sat every single day while in Washington for the entirety of his presidential term with a working level officer of the CIA to talk through the contents of the president's daily brief, the highest level intelligence publication there is. Some presidents before him had done it occasionally. Gerald Ford had done it for the first year he was president, but nobody did it for an entire 4-year term until George Bush. He also instituted a practice, knowing as a former director of Central Intelligence, as he was, knowing the sensitivity of the information that goes into this very exclusive document, he instituted a practice whereby he and the other recipients of the president's daily brief around town, such as the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, they would receive a briefer who would deliver this daily document, and they didn't have to have the briefer talk to them. They could simply read it and have the briefer sit in the corner of the room quietly. But the briefer would be there while the senior person in the government was reading this document or getting briefed on it, and then would take the daily brief back to CIA headquarters to keep it absolutely secure. In the Reagan administration, the vice president, George Bush, had seen copies of the president's daily brief floating around. People were making photocopies of it. As a former director of Central Intelligence, he told me that he was very upset by this. So it's no surprise to me that when he was president, he put in a new institution which really solidified that briefing relationship of having a working level intelligence officer in the room. And that has continued to a large measure ever since.
Kimberly Adams, let's talk about the president's economic legacy. It's one of the things he's perhaps better known for, not only the relationships he built with other nations, there was also NAFTA. And then there's that famous campaign line of read my lips, no new taxes. Yeah.
Well, and to the points we just heard, it's sort of a relic of a bygone era that one of the reasons he lost his next election was because he did raise taxes as part of a compromise with Democrats to address budget deficits. And that's something that I think we really struggle to see nowadays when it comes to these really severe economic issues like budget deficits, like funding for different federal programs, the ability to reach a compromise when it comes to competing economic interests. And, you know, it's a little bit ironic that, you know, we're remembering the person who signed NAFTA, even though it was ratified under Bill Clinton, as we are waiting for Congress to see what they're going to do on the renegotiated NAFTA agreement.
Yeah, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, which has been signed by the heads of state. It still has to go through Mexico's National Assembly, Canada's Parliament, and Congress.
Doesn't roll off the tongue the same way.
It really doesn't quite. NAFTA as opposed to the USMCA. Yeah, it takes a little bit more explaining. Jessica Taylor, what stood out to you among the memorials on a political level? At least for me, it was interesting to see the way that the services took place, particularly the presence of President and Mrs. Trump. The late President Bush made no secret of his disdain for Donald Trump. And then just the tone of the ceremony, which was kind of amazing. You don't get to see that often.
Yeah, I mean, President Bush, before he passed away, he said that he had voted for Hillary Clinton, and his son, George W. Bush, has said that he voted for someone else. So, I mean, this is the Bush family made no secret that they were no fans of Trump. And it's not hard to see why, given just this President Trump has had a disdain for the Bush family and the way that he attacked Jeb during the primaries as well. But, you know, what stood out to me was, yes, I mean, Trump, you could see him sitting there on that row of all the former presidents, and he just looked uncomfortable. And it was sort of striking to see him sitting there, and he just looked just very sort of like he felt out of place. But, you know, the tone contrast that it was easy for me, I think, to draw parallels to when John McCain passed away a few months ago. That service, which President Trump was not invited to, had a very clear rebuke to the Trump agenda. This one, it was sort of more implicit. There was nothing, you know, saying, you know, America is already great or things like that too. But you know, as David said, you know, it's that sort of bygone era, and just the things that George H.W. Bush stood for, his military service, for instance, you know, just he's the last president that we had that served in combat. And, you know, we've completely bypassed a generation of Vietnam veterans that probably are never going to serve in the White House. And so it was that, I think, that, and just this, you know, married to the same woman for 70 plus years.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, that whole family standing there. And it just was very striking. And, you know, I think it was very moving for a lot of people, you know, like you said, just sort of that where, you know, he talked about honor and civility and just character in a way that matters.
There was also go ahead, David.
Let me add one quick note, which is a lot of the takes after hearing those eulogies were what a dig at President Trump and how clearly these were references to the man sitting in the front pew. And I take exception to that because every single word spoken about George Herbert Walker Bush in the cathedral would have been said about him regardless of who was president. These were statements of remembrance about a man who had a life well lived and lived a life in public service. These were not attempts to subtly punch back at Donald Trump. These were ways to honor a great man.
There was also a kind of an augustness to the whole set of ceremonies just from the trip to Houston, the lying in state at the rotunda, you know, that shot of Bob Dole being helped up from his wheelchair to salute George W. Bush. Sully, the service dog,
sitting by the dog.
Oh, man, my mother texted me. She's like, why do I cry every time I see Sully on television? There was just kind of a there was a sweetness to it. There was an augustness to it.
Yeah.
The full military honors. Like, we don't see that often, but that's kind of part and parcel of the country.
And, I mean, funerals are a way for people to grieve and for, I think, as a country for us to grieve and to move on. You know, I grew up in the funeral business, in fact. So, I mean, you know, this is an important time for people to come together and to do this, you know, but, you know, there could be some, there's always sort of some awkward moments at funerals, too. And I think President Trump's presence had that effect. But largely, you know, there were so many other ways that people were honoring him, from people standing in line hours at the Capitol to pay their respects.
I know we have to pause momentarily, but there's also been this thread, Kimberly, in terms of the way we remember presidents in total. Farm Country tweeted, "Let's not forget the extremely racist, unfair Willie Horton ad when we remember George H.W. Bush. That was a new low in politics that rivaled Nixon." There seems to be this kind of a thread about the value of a eulogy versus the value of an obituary.
And you can say a similar thing about his economic policy. You know, we were just talking about NAFTA. NAFTA is something that a lot of people all over this country really feel strongly harmed manufacturing workers, harmed factory workers all over America, and really ushered in this idea that maybe free trade wasn't so great for everyone in America.
David, I'd like to get your take on this as well when we continue the Friday News Roundup with Kimberly Adams of Marketplace, NPR's Jessica Taylor, and political historian David Priest, the author of How to Get Rid of a President. We also welcome more of your questions and thoughts on this or any of the big stories from this week's news, and we'll get to some of the stories that are breaking at this hour. I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you on this Friday. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Unemployment is holding steady at 3.7%. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released its new job numbers this morning. There's been a lot of talk about a manufacturing slowdown given the news about tariffs and about General Motors closing plants, but there's not much sign of that in today's report. November's unemployment holds at the lowest rate in almost five decades. This indicates that the labor market is still healthy, but payrolls and wages rose less than expected. It's the Friday News Roundup with Marketplace senior reporter Kimberly Adams, David Priest of the Lawfare Institute, and NPR lead digital political reporter Jessica Taylor. We'd love to hear from you on any of the big stories this week that caught your attention across the country. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. Before I let David chime in about the multi-layered legacy of George H.W. Bush, two more comments from you. Phil in Michigan writes, "President Bush will be missed for sure, the last of a rare breed of kindness in public service." And Steve tweeted, "It is important to highlight the positives of key leaders. In all honesty, the press was anything but kind to President George H.W. Bush during his administration." David, I wonder what your thoughts are in terms of the way we remember the totality of a president like George H.W. Bush. I have to say, I feel like one of the things that I was surprised was not brought up more was Dana Carvey and his impersonation of the president on Saturday Night Live, not only because it resonated at the time, but because the president proved he could take a joke. Like, this legacy has got a lot of facets to it.
Right. Not just that he could take a joke, but he ended up becoming friends with Dana Carvey.
Yeah.
Ended up inviting him, in a sense, into the family, joking about it, enjoying it. And it did create a stark parallel in some people's mind for, could you imagine Donald Trump inviting Alec Baldwin, who impersonates him on Saturday Night Live, and bringing him into the family and laughing with him and listening to music? It buggers the imagination for that this could happen. On the issue of legacy, it is a complicated one. All of the things that have been said are true. Yes, he ran a horribly racist ad during a campaign. Yes, some of his policies don't look as good in retrospect as perhaps they did to some at the time. But that is the nature of a presidency. We don't have angels running for president. We have human beings. And every single one of them, even some of our icons in history, Abraham Lincoln, the more I learn about him, the more I realize what a flawed human being he was and how he rose above those challenges to overall have a great legacy. And that's really the overall picture. And during a funeral service is probably not the time when you're highlighting the worst decisions that someone has made in a decades-long public career. It's a time when you're talking about the values underlying that public career. But there's certainly a time in the obituaries and in the analysis to say, what could he have done better? What should he have done better? And what can we do better reflecting on that history?
All right, let's move on and talk about some big news from the White House. By the way, before we dive into this section of the roundup, please know that a number of the stories we're about to go through are moving as we speak. Some of them are stories that we expect to move throughout the day, so you'll want to stay in touch with your NPR member station for the latest on this and stay in touch online at npr.org. But we'll talk about what we know at the moment, and where we don't know, we'll just be clear about it, and we'll say that that hasn't become soup yet. So let's dive in with the White House and some big announcements from the administration. The president has announced that he will nominate William Barr to be the next attorney general, succeeding Jeff Sessions. He also announced that Heather Nauert will be the next U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. That'll be his nominee. Heather Nauert is now a spokesperson in the federal government, and then before that was a host on Fox and Friends. Let's learn a little bit more about these two, Jessica. Can you tell us a bit about William Barr? He actually has a connection to the late President Bush.
Yeah, he served as his attorney general, first as the deputy attorney general in the Bush, in the first Bush administration, and then as the attorney general in 91 to 93. And so he has experience running this, clearly. You know, it's been two decades since then. And his daughter, in fact, actually works at the DOJ already, working on opioid cases. You know, it's interesting because this isn't someone that's sort of, you know, within the Trump family or has been a big Trump supporter. So I think Trump is probably looking at this saying, here's someone who has been attorney general, and that gives him some credibility and possibly an easier confirmation battle. You know, of course, Republicans have gained seats in the Senate, so that makes it a little bit easier going in, but maybe dispel with some of the questions regarding that. And of course, the big question is, how will he deal with the Mueller investigation? And one thing that he has said, he has expressed concerns over political donations by Mueller's team, saying that, you know, he wishes that they'd maybe remained a little bit more neutral in that regard. And this, of course, is something that Trump has repeatedly tweeted about as well. So that's something that could certainly come up.
David Priest, how would you kind of handicap the relationship between President Trump and William Barr potentially compared to the, to put it mildly, contentious relationship that he had with Jeff Sessions?
It's hard to say because it's not as if they have a close personal relationship or have any history professionally of working together. And what we have seen repeatedly with the president is that when he has advisors, cabinet officials, who are doing their jobs and tell him news he doesn't want to hear, he lashes out. He punches back, as he says. He's a fighter. Well, sometimes they're just presenting to him what the law is, or in some cases, if it's policy advice, what they think would be best. So we don't know how that's going to work out. One of the interesting links with Bill Barr is that back when he was attorney general, and by the way, one of the youngest attorneys general in United States history, I believe he was 41 or so when he was made attorney general back in the Bush administration. But when he was attorney general, his assistant attorney general in charge of the criminal division was a man named Bob Mueller.
Let's talk about Heather Nauert now. Kimberly Adams, people have been kind of critical of her resume throughout, much more journalism and communications than politics or diplomacy. Not that I have anything
wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with being a journalist, but there's that question of whether or not she has just the experience to be the chief ambassador of the United States. What's the read right now on Heather Nauert?
Well, I mean, I think we should step back and recognize that throughout his administration, President Trump has made it very clear that it's not necessarily someone's resume that matters the most to him when he's making these decisions. He cares a lot about personal relationships. He cares a lot about loyalty. He cares a lot about how individuals present in a role or play the part. And so, you know, regardless of, you know, her diplomatic credentials, President Trump has obviously made the decision that he feels that she can do this job because of who she is and how she communicates and how she interacts with him. Within the diplomatic press corps, you've obviously had some criticism of her for some gaffes that she has made in terms of, I think she made a flawed reference to D-Day as being a part of our good relationship with Germany. But for the most part, I mean, I think if you put somebody from a journalism background in that position, you're obviously going to get some of those gaffes. We'll see if it passes the muster of the Senate.
Let's talk about the Russia investigation. Today's a big day for Special Counsel Mueller's investigation into the Trump campaign. Soon we'll learn more about what exactly former advisor Paul Manafort is accused of lying about. Also, sentencing recommendations for former Trump lawyer Michael Cohen are likely to come down. And James Comey, the former director of the FBI, is back on Capitol Hill today. He will answer questions from the House Judiciary Committee and the House Oversight Committee behind closed doors. All of this comes amid the release of a heavily blacked out memo, a heavily redacted document regarding former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and the information he provided to Robert Mueller's investigators. Let's pull this apart piece by piece, Jessica, starting with Michael Flynn. We've gotten a few comments regarding Mr. Flynn. Cosmic Miami tweeted, "By many accounts, Flynn had a distinguished military career. Why he pimped himself out is unknown, or maybe it is, and will be known soon." Is that kind of the crux of what we're waiting to learn about Michael Flynn as to why he decided to do what he was accused of having done?
Yeah, I mean, there were so many redactions in that it's hard to draw too much from it. But I think the big thing that you could see is that he met with investigators 19 times. It's clear that Mueller believes that Flynn gave him substantial firsthand information that is credible, which stands in contrast sort of with what Manafort was seemed to have cooperated with him, that they believe that he reneged on that a little bit and stuff too. So they believe that Flynn has provided assistance. You know, what it could be, it could be something with Turkey, which he had a lot of dealings with. It could be with money that was tied to the Trump inaugural fund and different things too. So it's sort of a little bit unclear as of yet what sort of information he provided. But you're right. I mean, he is someone who had a military background, but then he sort of came into Trump's orbit, sort of bought into that. You know, he was chanting "lock her up" at the RNC convention and things like that too. So it's a little bit unclear sort of yet.
We should also be clear, Jessica, some of these documents as they've been provided are so heavily redacted, it's almost impossible to make heads or tails of them except that they exist. And they kind of, it's almost as if the document had been like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, it would have been Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer had a very shiny redacted.
It's Mad Libs.
Then Santa came to say redacted.
There could be anything.
Down in history,
right,
the end. Like,
right.
Right. It could be anything in between these.
Yeah. But I think, again, what is clear is that he has been helpful to the Mueller investigation. And that is a, you know, that is someone from Trump's orbit that seems to have flipped and to have provided some sort of information enough that was valuable to them that he's not recommending any jail time.
I am challenging one of our listeners to come up with a song called Rudolph the Redacted Reindeer. I want that song by Christmas Day. Give us a sense of what James Comey, David Priest, is being called to testify about. The fact that he is testifying is part of the story, but also the way that he is testifying has been a big part of the story too.
Yes, he fought the request that he testify behind closed doors. He says he wants to be an open book. He wants everybody to understand everything that's being asked and everything that's being answered, and is a little bit nervous about what's going to happen behind closed doors and then be misrepresented afterwards. So he fought, I believe, going to court even to try to find a way to get out of this impasse. And essentially they settled on the fact that, yes, he would testify behind closed doors, but a transcript would be made available so people would know what was said. There's also very little holding him back from coming out of the hearing and describing what was asked and what he said. But the focus is not going to be on his firing by the president. The focus is going to be on what were his decisions in 2016, why was he making them, particularly related to Hillary Clinton, revisiting that again. I think there will be more heat than light from this. I'm not sure we'll learn too much from this, as opposed to some of the sentencing memos for Cohen and the details of Manafort's cooperation or lack thereof. I think that will be more enlightening than the Comey hearings. But let's be honest, this is a gift to the president in that when there's a bunch of other news coming out that is likely to be less than encouraging to the president, you can just bring up Comey again and he can keep talking about that and trying to distract some attention away from the other bad news coming.
Well, of course, this is Republicans' sort of last gasp, but
trying
to get this out too, because Democrats have taken control of Congress. They now have the oversight oversight role. They can subpoena and things too. So, you know, you have the outgoing Judiciary Committee, Bob Goodlatte, who is doing this. He's retiring. So it's sort of their last way to sort of bring him in, as David said, sort of shift headlines and things to a focus on what happened in 2016, which has largely sort of been litigated to an extent. And, you know, I don't think we're going to see Democrats focusing on that much.
Also, also today that's in the last few minutes, the president tweeted, "We will be doing a major counter report to the Mueller report. This should never again be allowed to happen to a future president of the United States." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Kimberly Adams, I think the character in this I'm the most fascinated by is Michael Cohen. His role in this just keeps on evolving, and it's the fact that he provided information in exchange for a plea deal. He's become this kind of this new character in the drama that Donald Trump has pointed to as kind of the illegitimacy of this whole Mueller probe. Like, I feel like the Michael Cohen part of this, at least for me, is the most fascinating.
The made-for-TV movie?
So, totally. Yeah.
Well, and what's interesting about those heavily redacted Flynn documents is almost the signal that they send to other people in this investigation or getting caught up in this of, you know, play along and here's what you might be able to get. In the same way that President Trump, according to many people who are looking at his tweets, is trying to signal to people using the example of Manafort that, you know, don't play along or Roger Stone or someone like that. Don't play along and, you know, you will still stay in my good graces. Now, you know, Michael Cohen's story is very interesting. At one point, he said he'd take a bullet for the president. And now his lawyers are out there saying, you know, he wants to completely follow the law and he's turned a new leaf. And there was a compass metaphor in there somewhere as well. There's a wide orbit of people getting caught up in this who are having to make real decisions based on real legal fees and real consequences for both themselves and their families about how they're going to deal with this. There was a tweet this morning who I wish I could attribute it to the right person who was saying, you know, if you were Trump's dog, you'd probably want a lawyer at this point.
One more thing, David, as someone who definitely has needed a lawyer for some time is Paul Manafort. I wonder, before we keep moving, what you think in terms of how his situation will shake out. Investigators say he lied to the FBI. Manafort's lawyers say their client believed he was being truthful. What do we think happens to Paul Manafort going forward?
The details here will matter greatly. There's no way in which this document will come out, unless a lot of it's redacted again, in which case we're in the same place we were with Michael Flynn. But the details should show exactly what he was untruthful about and exactly how they know. That is, what documents do they have or other testimony that is credible, which shows what he was saying that was deceiving investigators. You put it all together, too, and you get a really interesting game going on here, if you will, which is Michael Flynn, in perhaps the most serious position in the U.S. government pertaining to national security, with access to every bit of information that the intelligence community produces, was committing crimes at the time. But Mueller decided that he actually provided enough cooperation that he would recommend no prison sentence. If we see a similar thing with Michael Cohen, which is a dramatic decrease in the recommended sentence, mm-hmm. That's a real signal to other witnesses, especially paired off with the Manafort issue, that you cooperate and we will look out for you. You don't cooperate and we are going to hold you to the details that we have in other testimony.
Speaking of prison time, it's worth noting that former Trump foreign policy advisor George Papadopoulos wrapped up his 2-week prison sentence today. He was released from custody in Wisconsin just a few minutes ago. I know we got to pause in a moment, but I at least want to start our conversation about this Senate hearing, the briefing from CIA head Gina Haspel. A bipartisan group of senators agreed that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was responsible for the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. That includes Republican Senators Richard Shelby and Lindsey Graham. Senator Graham spoke to Martha McCallum Wednesday on Fox News.
I've gone from being this guy's biggest champion to being his biggest nightmare. And I would advise the president that people are sizing you up. The Iranians are looking at you. The Russians are looking at you. And this guy has basically disrespected us, you, and the nation and all of our values.
But you don't
think that
message is
getting
through.
If you let him get away with this, Mr. President, then you're sending a signal that you're just about transactions. You're not somebody special. And the president of the United States needs to be somebody special.
That was Republican Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina speaking to Fox News. We'll get into our analysis of this as we continue the Friday News Roundup with NPR's Jessica Taylor, Kimberly Adams of Marketplace, and political historian David Priest. Before we go, a song that broke the internet this week. The music video for Thank You Next by Ariana Grande. It set a record for the most YouTube views in one day. The video pays tribute to the movies of the early aughts like Legally Blonde that center around female characters. You'll find a link to watch it on our Twitter feed. We are at 1A. Back to the Friday News Roundup in just a moment. Stay close.
Look what you taught me. Yeah, more than I say. Thank you. Next, thank you. Next.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Kimberly Adams, Jessica Taylor, and David Priest. Still time to get in your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories, 1A@WAMU.org. Jessica, we played that clip from Senator Lindsey Graham, and we've been talking about how senators have increasingly coalesced around the belief, the very solid belief at this point, that there's no way that Jamal Khashoggi could have been killed without the Crown Prince knowing about it, directing it, masterminding it, etc. I wonder what your sense is of this moment. This briefing seems to have been a turning point for some reason, but even if it is, it remains to be seen kind of what Congress is going to do about it.
Yeah, I mean, and Graham, I think, is the central figure in all of this, because as he even said, I mean, Graham is someone who despised Trump during the primaries, really berated him, and then has interestingly become one of his closest friends.
Right.
And on this, he is clearly breaking with him. You know, he said there's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. And, you know, Bob Corker, the head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who's leaving, he said, you know, if you had seen this information, you would have convicted them within 30 minutes, or, you know, I think he said even 20 minutes later on. And, you know, just how they can draw such a succinct conclusion when Trump supposedly got the same information and has wavered just is such a it's just striking. And you're right. You know, what they can do, resolutions are different things, too. But I mean, Trump is still at the head of this. And it really, I think, sends a signal to the rest of the questions. What kind of a signal it sends to the rest of the world when you have the Senate saying one thing and then Trump still very much wavering. And then, you know, there's reports this week that the Saudis spent so much money on one of his hotels and different things, too. So it's a complicated web in there, too. And what it says about us as Americans and being able to tolerate, you know, this, too.
David Priest, I'd love to get your insights on this as someone with experience in the CIA, what it means for the director of the CIA, Gina Haspel, to brief a bipartisan group of senators, what the import of that was.
It's a stark example of something I've seen many times, which is you have some very good intelligence, sometimes exquisite intelligence, that the analysts put together along with what is unknown and their confidence levels, and it presents a very strong picture, something that you can say with high confidence is happening. But it is something short of direct evidence. That is, we don't have an actual transcript of person A saying something to person B. Well, what's always interesting is to see the reaction to that, is some people will say, this is as tight a case as we'll ever get. Let's go forward. Some people will say, but we don't have the smoking gun. You haven't proven it. And I think we're seeing that played out in a very stark way here. The president and some others are saying, well, we don't know exactly what happened. Well, that may be true. And it can also be true that the preponderance of evidence that we do have points to something happening. The CIA director's job is to go to the Hill and give briefings when requested to inform the relevant committees about what they know. That is part of the oversight role. And let's not forget, Congress has some real tools here. Yes, the president is commander in chief. Yes, he controls foreign policy. But the Senate can block arms sales. They can defund programs related to Saudi Arabia. They can hold public hearings and keep a spotlight on this as long as they want to. They can make this a center point of the confirmation hearings for the UN ambassador if they want to. There are many tools that Congress has to make sure that the spotlight does not go away.
Let's shift gears to congressional politics and politics across the country. Democrats are on the way into Wisconsin state legislature, but the Republicans, who are currently in charge, dealt them a blow on the way out. Republicans in Wisconsin approved a sweeping set of bills on Wednesday to limit the power of the newly elected Democrats. Those rules include a new limit on early voting and ceding control of a major economic board to the lawmakers instead of to the incoming governor. We did a longer discussion on that this week, which you can find online at the1a.org. But Kimberly Adams, part of the discussion that we had basically had to do with whether or not this is just politics as usual in 2018, whether this is the way that it's going to go. It's kind of like, you know, selling somebody your house, and then when they arrive, they find that you left the lawnmower running in the living room and said, enjoy your new home. Or whether this is actually unlawful, immoral. This is not the kind of thing that should be tolerated. I feel like that's kind of where the debate sits right now.
I think, well, this isn't the first time this has happened.
No,
we've
no.
seen this elsewhere in previous elections, but this is a bit more visible, perhaps, in light of some of the other things that have been going on and these real questions about what it means and what should happen when control of it, whether it be a state house or Congress, changes from one party to the other. And so immoral or illegal, that's going to be probably hashed out in the courts, because as I understand it, they're going to be fighting some of these decisions. But elections have consequences. And we say this all the time, but previous elections have consequences for the current ones. Your previous elections in, you know, Alabama or Georgia have, you know, have an impact on how an election goes, you know, in terms of voter access. The previous election here, in this case that we're talking about, has an impact on what happened for the next incoming governor. And so we saw record jumps in voter turnout in the midterm election, especially among young voters. But this is one of these things that really indicates the importance of voting over time in terms of how transitions happen, as well as who actually comes into power.
And of course, early voting is one of the things that's affected by these rules. Thanks also to those of you in Michigan and Wisconsin and North Carolina and Ohio and states that have been affected by this. Matt in Wisconsin writes, "This power grab in Wisconsin is a violation of the spoken voice of the people." By the way, lest we think the midterm elections are over, don't be silly. They're not quite over, including not in North Carolina's 9th congressional district. Multiple investigations are currently underway into whether a Republican campaign worker used absentee ballots to alter the vote in Bladen County. The head of the North Carolina Republican Party says if the fraud allegations are true, they plan to call for a new election. At the moment, at last check, the Republican candidate, Mark Harris, leads his Democratic rival by about 900 votes. One more thing, Jessica Taylor, before we move on from politics, the eternal betting match in terms of like who might run for 2020, former vice president, which is my least favorite parlor game in Washington. Like, if you're going to run, say you're running so we can talk to you about running. But former Vice President Joe Biden says he is, in his words, the most qualified person to run for president in 2020, added that whether he runs will depend on whether or not his family is ready. Should we even be like, what should we be paying attention to at this point?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a list of like 40 people at this point that can run for, you know, vice president. During 2016, we had the sort of like varsity debate and the junior varsity debate. We may have like a third varsity debate or something.
Like a Pop Warner debate or something.
Yeah, for the Democrats. Who knows who's going to run? I mean, Biden is someone who I think clearly had his son Beau not passed away right before he was having to make that decision. I think he would have run in 2016. And who knows how history would have been changed by that. He is someone who I think has always sort of coveted this, truly does believe he is qualified. You have a lot of people that are urging him. He's also someone that has shown that he can sort of speak to this blue-collar Democrat in a way, the populist Democrat that President Trump was able to appeal to. So I think he's someone that's going to be in the conversation. We did have two people say this week that they were not going to run. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has said he will not run, so cross that one off the list. And I think to the relief of many in the Democratic Party, lawyer Michael Avenatti has now said he is not going to run. So hopefully we can move on past that.
Although David, it's interesting, you know, when he said that he's the most qualified, my first thought was, okay, well, what does that actually mean you're going to be president? I mean, it takes more than qualification to lead. Abraham Lincoln once said, with public sentiment, all things are possible. Without it, nothing is possible. And I just wonder if the question in 2020 comes down to whether the Democrats need someone qualified, like Joe Biden, or one might argue Hillary Clinton, or whether they need someone moving, like Beto O'Rourke, let's say, like what the Democrats actually need to upset a president who won by being influential.
And there are parallels for each one. You can find people with great resumes like a George H.W. Bush who became president. But you can also find a person who ran for a Senate seat and lost and then was president a couple of years later. And that's Abraham Lincoln. Now, that is the last case when that has happened. But Beto O'Rourke actually could look back to that as a model for seizing the opportunity as it arises. Because, look, who has the experience? Maybe it's Joe Biden. There is some excitement for him, but not overwhelming. Elizabeth Warren seems to be prepping for a run, certainly at the National Cathedral when all of the senators and representatives were there after the service mingling. It looked like she was holding court. She had people coming up to her, talking to her. She was definitely in that campaignish moment. But the excitement around one candidate just isn't happening. And maybe it is a moment for somebody who has the charisma, who has the ideas, and can say that I've had enough experience that I can pull off a Barack Obama, where pulling on that limited experience, but being able to govern with the right support around me.
Let's shift gears now away from politics and talk about USA Gymnastics. The organization is still flailing in the aftermath of the disgraced former team doctor Larry Nassar and his conviction on hundreds of sexual assault charges. This week, USA Gymnastics filed for bankruptcy. According to the Wall Street Journal, the filing would, in its words, put an automatic stop to depositions and discovery related to USA Gymnastics lawsuits that were filed by Mr. Nassar's victims. Kimberly Adams, I get that this going bankrupt kind of changes the way that legal filings happen, but it kind of makes me wonder about the future of USA Gymnastics as an organization. I mean, the U.S. Olympic Committee was taking steps to revoke its status as the governing body of the sport here in the U.S., so it feels like the future of gymnastics in the whole country at an Olympic level is very much up in the air.
Right, and I think my guess is where we're going to see this going is going to rely very much on the gymnasts themselves, as opposed to the people in these organizations, as opposed to the leaders in these training facilities all over the country and all of these various disgraced individuals at this point. And I think you're seeing a lot of leadership from the gymnasts themselves in carving out where gymnastics in the United States is going to go, especially from people like Simone Biles. And, you know, with the bankruptcy filing, it does change the dynamic a little bit, but there had to be some kind of reckoning. And I think this is just the beginning of it.
I will say, too, if you're Michigan Public Radio has put out an excellent podcast called Believed that digs into the Larry Nassar scandal. It is just heartbreaking, riveting. I didn't fully understand everything about how we got to this point and how for so many years people had sort of believed him. And then ultimately it's the gymnast that's being believed. It's really excellent.
It's called Believed by Michigan Radio.
Yes.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. With regards to the insurance piece, Kimberly, there's also that aspect of the matter of Les Moonves, the former chairman and CEO of the CBS Corporation. The New York Times reported that Moonves actively obstructed the investigation into the allegations of sexual assault and harassment against him that were leveled by more than a dozen women. He stepped down as the CEO of CBS in September, and one of the issues is this severance package that's worth $120 million.
You know, these golden parachutes have been a real source of pain and frustration for these victims. The idea that people, maybe they'll lose their job, but still get some kind of cushy exit has been very painful for a lot of these women. And there's a real chance that now Moonves might lose his because he is, according to this report, obstructing the investigation. And we had quite a discussion at Marketplace over, you know, what the responsibility is when it comes to a corporate board of notifying your shareholders about something like this, because there were people who knew. And at what point are you obligated legally to start notifying people, hey, this is going to affect our business? Not only does it make us look terrible, not only may there be crimes committed, but this is something that might affect the financials of the organization. So there are a lot of questions that still have to be played out here. And it's the story just keeps getting grosser and grosser, honestly.
A few more quick stories we want to get to before our time is up. Who wouldn't want a free trip to Washington? That's what a group of military veterans were given in exchange for their support of Saudi lobbyists after the last election, the 2016 election. The vets were put up in the Trump International Hotel in downtown D.C. over the course of 3 months for a total of 500 room reservations. The bill came out to $270,000. This and other transactions at the hotel and other Trump-owned entities are the focus of subpoenas filed by attorneys general in Maryland and D.C. this week. Jessica, give us a sense of what this is all about, where this stands, why this matters.
I mean, this was a major step forward in the case that they were allowed to issue these 30 subpoenas. And this is moving forward. This is the first time that the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution will have been challenged in court. And, it's looking at whether the Trump organization and, you know, Trump and his really resistance to separate himself from his business and whether he is receiving a boost by countries and states trying to curry favor with him by having these things there. And I think this story from the Post about the Saudis moving their hotel rooms from Northern Virginia to the Trump Hotel right after the election only sort of seems to give further credence to this fact that countries wanted to sort of curry favor with the president by doing this.
Kim?
One of the problems with that a lot of these charges of emoluments violations have had in the courts up till now have been this idea of demonstrating real harm. And that's why you see so much attention on these hotels and these night stays and the value of these, because Maryland and Virginia can actually lay out, we have hotels and we have properties that previously had that business, and now it's going here. And right. So that this is moving forward because, unlike some of these previous groups that have brought these cases, there's harm that they can demonstrate.
Before we head into the weekend, a little bit of entertainment news. It's award season coming up in Hollywood. Today we learned that comedian Kevin Hart has pulled out of his role as next year's host of the Oscars. It was made in response to public outcry about past disparaging comments Hart has made regarding LGBTQ people. Offensive tweets from as far back as 2009 have resurfaced in recent days. Hart has addressed them directly on social media. The actor says he is a changed man. He initially declined to apologize and then offered the apology by way of saying he would no longer host the Oscars. Speaking of the awards, the nominations for the Golden Globes came out yesterday, and there were a few surprises.
I, Zuri, son of Badu, give to you Prince T'Challa, the Black Panther.
The blockbuster story of the Marvel superhero from Wakanda was nominated for Best Picture, a category that has historically shunned comic book film adaptations. Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse was also nominated for Best Animated Film. Can you tell we're comic book nerds? I can't tell. In addition to Black Panther, several of the movies we reviewed in the 1A Movie Club got nominated, including Crazy Rich Asians, A Star is Born, and Green Book. They're all up for Best Picture awards. The Golden Globes air Sunday, January 6th. If you want to hear those movie club conversations, you'll find them at the1a.org. And before we go, one of our listeners named Craig took up my challenge. Craig writes, Rudolph the Redacted Reindeer had some very helpful prose. If you had ever grilled him, you'd know how the story goes.
That's really good.
Five stars to Craig.
Well,
yes.
Played.
Yes, Craig. Please send us your information. Let me send you an autographed 1A mug.
We have to set that to music.
Yes. Let me send you some 1A swag. Thank you, Craig. NPR's lead digital political reporter, Jessica Taylor. Thanks, Jessica.
Thanks, Joshua.
Kimberly Adams, senior reporter with Marketplace. Thanks, Kimberly.
Happy to be here.
And David Priest, chief operating officer of the Lawfare Institute. His book is called How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. Thanks, David.
Thank you, Joshua.
1A's lead sound engineer is Jake Cherry. Our digital team is Gabrielle Healy and Catherine Fink. You can learn more about them and the rest of our staff at the1a.org/staff. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.